Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. On this week's program, we'll be discussing the chronic, very unpredictable disease of the central nervous system, multiple sclerosis. My guests are Dr. Deborah Bradshaw, Neurology Residency Program Director at SUNY Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York, and Karen Ann Petracca, a woman who was diagnosed with and has been living with MS since 2004. And thank you for joining me. I want to begin with you, Dr. Bradshaw. Let's talk a little bit about what multiple sclerosis even is. Can you tell us a little bit?
Sure. It's a disease of the central nervous system. That means brain and spinal cord, not the nerves or muscles. It's an autoimmune disease, meaning that the body's immune system seems to attack a portion of the nervous system, and the part that we're most confident that it attacks are the myelin sheaths of the axons. That's the coating around the nerves that is analogous to insulation around wires. And it affects people in young adulthood, typically 20 to 40. It can occur earlier than that and later, but most patients develop symptoms in their young adult years. And there's an array of symptoms that can occur.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Tell us what some of the most typical ones. The one I know is numbness. And,
Yep. In fact, numbness, I think, is the commonest initial symptom. It can affect the optic nerve, causing visual loss and eye pain. It can affect the cerebellum, which is the balance center of the brain, and can cause unsteadiness of walking and movements. And it can also cause weakness.
Now, I've heard that it typically only causes numbness on one side at a time. Is that correct very often?
Can be, although a lesion, a problem, we would call it a plaque in the spinal cord, could give you numbness in both legs, for example. So the specific symptoms or distribution of symptoms depends on where the inflammation is in the nervous system.
And how common is it for people to go into remission in the early years and be perfectly healthy for a time and then the onset of the symptoms happen again? Talk to us about that.
Well, there are several different types of MS, and they're characterized by the time course that they follow. And by far and away, the most common time course is what we call relapsing remitting. And that means that there'll be clinical attacks, which over time, even without treatment, tend to improve even back to normal. The frequency of those attacks varies a great deal. Over time, those patients tend to enter a second phase of the illness, which is called secondary progressive, where instead of the up-down course, there's a sort of a slow, gradual decline in function. A much smaller proportion have what's called primary progressive multiple sclerosis, and that begins as a slow, steady progression.
Well, Karen Ann, I want you to tell us a little bit about your experience. You were diagnosed in March of 2004, just a couple months.
Coming up on my seven-year anniversary, actually.
Yeah, so you were diagnosed a couple months before your 28th birthday. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the diagnosis and what your life was like and so on.
At the time, I was living in Berlin, Germany. On a Saturday afternoon, I realized that the symptoms I was having were so serious and so unusual that I needed to seek medical help, and so I went to the hospital. The problems were that I'd had a persistent and splitting headache for more than a week. My right hand was numb, and on that morning, I had actually gone virtually blind in my right eye.
Scary that must have been.
It was terribly frightening. I came home from work, I was a teacher at the time, and said to my partner, I think I need to see a neurologist. I knew instinctively that there must be something going wrong with my nervous system. I was admitted to the hospital that very day. I had excellent medical care. The team of doctors that was very attentive and kind and thorough. They subjected me, I think, to just about every test available for diagnosing multiple sclerosis, but I appreciated their thoroughness. And by the fifth day, they knew for certain what it was. And I had also been getting, during those 5 days, I had been getting a standard course of the intravenous corticosteroid to tamp down the inflammation, which would have been administered even if I hadn't had multiple sclerosis.
Now, did you suspect that you might have multiple sclerosis because your father had it?
That's a tough question. I sort of oscillated between dreading that and knowing it somewhere in my gut and denying it because I felt I was in the prime of my life. I felt incredibly healthy. I was a competitive runner. I prided myself maybe even a little bit too much on my physical dynamism, and I identified myself with it. So during those 5 days, there were moments when I knew for sure that I had this disease that my father has. And there were just as many moments when I thought, no, it can't be, not me.
I can understand that. Now, Dr. Rasher, there's been theories about where MS comes from. And they're even saying childhood infections. Do we know at all? Can we put a finger on any of this at this point?
Well, we don't know, but we know that there are several contributing factors. People with family members who have multiple sclerosis are at increased risk for it. It's not inherited and passed down from generation to generation in a predictable way, such as other genetic disorders are, but definitely that's one component of risk. Mm-hmm. It's thought that there may be viral triggers. They've looked at different viruses, and there is an association with the Epstein-Barr virus. So it's a combination of genetics and environmental exposure. There's new evidence and pretty exciting stuff about vitamin D.
I've been hearing about that, yeah.
Yeah. So it's been known for many, many years that the risk of MS increases the further away you move from the equator. And it's been a little difficult to understand. But now there's recognition that vitamin D, which is called a sunshine vitamin, probably plays a role in the risk of developing MS and probably even in preventing relapses once the disease is acquired. So there's evidence that a mother's exposure to sunlight or her vitamin D levels either raises or lowers the risk of MS in her child.
God, that's amazing, isn't it? Really? And back to the Epstein-Barr, that's the virus that causes mononucleosis, correct?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So that's interesting, too, all these little connections.
So it's what we'd call a multifactorial disorder with several contributing elements. And now there's even a lot of interest in the venous insufficiency theory about MS, that the veins from the head and neck are constricted, causing an inflammatory response in the brain. That's being looked at.
That's still a theory.
I'm making faces.
A lot of people are actually pretty skeptical about that.
Yeah.
But there's been an interest in, there's been recognition that the veins play a role in MS because the inflammation that you look at under the microscope begins around small veins or venules.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And even back a couple of hundred years, neurologists have been interested in the venous drainage of the brain and how it connects to MS. So there may be something there, and there are some clinical trials looking at that now.
Hmm. Well, Karen, I want to continue your story. When you were released from the hospital finally, you said in your biography that you were told to go home, be happy, and that you would probably go into remission and have a normal life for a while. Tell us what happened.
In short, that's not what happened. Part of me was thrilled to hear from my diagnosing doctors that my prognosis was good. They had every reason to believe that MS was not going to get me. And I wanted to believe that same thing. At the time, of course, I knew relatively little about the disease. And so I was happy to leave the hospital thinking that I could continue with my normal life and still have MS. But from that day forward, my MS seemed to be, it seemed to me to be a raging onslaught. It didn't let up for a year and a half. And it got to the point where I could feel myself becoming more and more disabled by the day. And it was the most destroying part of my life so far.
Yeah.
By, 18 months to 2 years after my diagnosis, I definitely needed a walker for ambulation and eventually a wheelchair. I would like to say that I am by no means a typical case. Most people who are diagnosed do not wind up needing a wheelchair within 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's a function of my bad luck that most of the lesions in my multiple sclerosis are in my spinal cord and in my cerebellum, and that has led directly to the problems that I have with balance and with weakness in my leg muscles that makes it very difficult for me to walk. I want to say that and make it very clear so that people don't get a false impression or misunderstand that this is what happens when you get MS. It's just what happened to me.
Yeah, yeah. And did you start going on drugs immediately, and did it alleviate some of the symptoms and help you at all?
Like I said, I was given the corticosteroid in the hospital as a matter of course, and that should have tamped down the initial inflammation and allowed me to transition into a stage of recovery. I think it was minimally effective, but what's probably more important is that I was advised straight away not to go on any of the long-term preventative immunomodulating medications, because some doctors believe that if you've just had your first exacerbation, your initial onset of multiple sclerosis, that you don't necessarily need to be on a drug yet. And again, my doctors had this, I don't know, we could maybe call it faith in my health. And it was like they didn't want to tamper or meddle any more with my life as it was currently conceived than they needed to.
Do you think that was a mistake?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did they think it was a mistake too?
In retrospect, they might have, but I do not blame them one bit for calling that shot. This is a disease that, like you said in your introduction, is totally unpredictable. It's absolutely capricious.
Yeah.
Nobody knew, you know, least of all me, and not even them, what was in store for me. And so, you know, while I think intellectually that it was regrettable for me not to have started straight off on the medication, I don't blame anybody.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Dr. Bradshaw, let's discuss what medications and therapies are available for people with MS. Talk to us about the early stages, what they use these days, and what's recommended.
Well, there's a lot available, and I would say there are three categories of drugs that we use. First would be the steroids that Karen Ann referred to, which are used, during an acute attack to shorten the duration of the attack. They don't affect the long-term outcome of the illness, but they will bring the patient to a more functional state more rapidly. So that's one. In the early 90s, we entered the era of disease-modifying treatment, where actually the medications we give now can slow worsening of the illness and reduce the frequency of the attacks.
Mm-hmm.
There are four available. They're all injectable, and there are pros and cons with each one of them. And they overall reduce the attack rate by about 30%. So there is certainly not a cure, but all neurologists have seen patients who stabilize for many, many years on the treatment.
You know, I read a little bit about this before the show, and aren't there a lot of side effects potentially with some of these drugs, and isn't that one of the problems still?
Well, there are side effects, although patients do remarkably well on them for years.
Mm-hmm.
The side effects vary a little bit. They tend to be about the same in terms of effectiveness. So we choose which one to give based on what side effects we least want. And patient preference enters into it a lot. Some of the injections are weekly, some of them are daily, and so forth. There are some new drugs that are extremely potent with even more dramatic benefit, but also more dangerous side effects.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about multiple sclerosis with Dr. Deborah Bradshaw, a neurologist from SUNY Upstate Medical University, and Karen Ann Petracca, a patient who has had MS since 2004. Do you want to continue on this talk about drugs and so on? I wanted to know if there's a recommended exercise regimen, diet. Does any of that seem to help?
Well, let me just finish talking about the medications,
sure.
And we can talk about the other aspects. So we're talking about disease-modifying drugs, drugs that actually alter the course of the illness, prevent attacks, and prevent the accumulation of disability or reduce the accumulation of disability. And it's a very exciting time now because there are, I think, six or more new drugs that are either recently approved or in the pipeline. And just in the past several months, we had our first oral drug approved. So people are very excited about that. Some of the newer drugs, more potent immunosuppressive drugs, though, do have some potentially dangerous side effects.
Mm-hmm.
So the patient and the neurologist decide together, based on how well the patient is doing on current treatment, whether to go to one of the newer stronger medications. But the third class of medications we use are for symptom control. So I'm sure Karen Ann knows about spasticity. It's a stiffening of the legs that occurs when there is damage to the spinal cord. That can be very painful, can be very limiting, and we have good drugs that have been around for a long time to reduce the stiffness. Bladder and bowel tend to be severely affected, and we have medications that can help with those problems. Fatigue is a huge problem with MS, and sometimes it's even the most disabling symptom, and we have medication to help with the fatigue. So there are three different ways to attack it, and we use those things in combination often.
Karen, and I want to talk to you about this too. Within a year, like you said, you needed a wheelchair, you needed a walker, you were really debilitated in regard to being able to move very well, and you became suicidal. And can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. I don't distinguish between mind and body. I don't believe in any sort of duality like that. And so for me, I am my body. And with every day that I was losing ability, it was as though I was losing another very important part of myself. And I got to the point where I felt utterly destroyed, and I was not sure that it was possible for me to create a new life with these circumstances that I had been dealt. And not only that, I didn't know if I wanted to.
Yeah.
And that left me seriously suicidal for a chunk of time. But I felt, you know, philosophically, I felt entitled to that decision. And I will say, even today, I am glad I'm here. I was able to create a life with my MS and its symptoms and my disabilities. I enjoy my life, but I stand by my right to have made that other decision.
And can you tell us what switched your mind about that? How you actually decided to live?
You know, I was very open with family and friends about what I was thinking and feeling. Most of the feedback that I got was displeasure and very stubborn discouragement. And I understood that, of course, because I was asking people who loved me deeply to understand my desire to end my life. That was not a really big help to me. What helped me in the end was advice that I got from my therapist, who's known me since I was 12 years old, who said, "I think it's cowardly. I think it's cowardly of you to quit before you've even tried. The fact of the matter is that you don't know what you're capable of, and you don't know if you give it your serious best, you don't know what will come out on the other side in the way of a life." And she sort of made a deal with me. She said, if you try, and you try for a couple of years, and you are unsuccessful or dissatisfied at the close of this experiment, then fine, I will support you in your decision to commit suicide, but not yet. That's the cowardly way out. And she knew me at that point well enough to know that I'm not a coward. That was convincing enough for me.
Wow, that's an amazing story, Karen Ann. It really is.
It was a powerful moment for me.
Yeah.
It really was. Yeah. And that was the condition for me, you know, that if I was going to stick around, it wasn't going to be with half an effort, that I was going to work at it. And I've tried very hard to stick with that conviction since then. It just otherwise isn't worth it to me.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Bradshaw, on that note, as a neurologist, you take care of symptoms and the body and some of the conditions that happen during this disease. What do you do about people's mental states? How do you deal with that as a doctor?
Well, that's a very important issue, and I'm glad this topic came up because it's one area that we can offer help in. Patients with MS have a much higher risk of depression and suicide than other people without it. So it's perceived by the medical community as part of the illness. Of course, there's also the depression that comes with a shock, the loss and grief that would accompany loss of health and that sort of thing. So there's a reactive component, but it's also part of the illness. And we work pretty hard to address that component. There are very effective antidepressants. Exercise is extremely important. It's an effective antidepressant. It's actually as effective as some of the antidepressants that we take in pill form. It also improves the fatigue in MS and the sense of well-being. So There's another aspect, too, which is cognitive impairment. Folks with MS have some trouble with memory, and this tends to be more the case later in the course of the illness. Difficulty multitasking, paying attention, and there are lots of things that contribute to that, including the fatigue, and sometimes depression can affect the memory. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge aspect of what we do. Patients, I think many people benefit from psychotherapy, someone to talk to. And then the general health elements, exercise, good quality sleep, good nutrition, fun, sunshine. We now know sunshine's important.
Do you try to get people to go on an anti-inflammatory diet? Have you done that, Karen Ann, gone on a specific diet for this?
I really haven't. I was a vegetarian before I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and it was philosophically very important to me to continue being a vegetarian. The myelin sheath that Dr. Bradshaw referred to earlier is composed of proteins and fatty acids, and there are people who believe that if you don't seriously increase your intake of protein when you get a disease like MS, you're putting yourself at a disadvantage. But there are plenty of vegetarian sources of protein.
Still a vegetarian?
Wow. I do eat mostly whole foods. I do organic as much as possible. But again, this was a lifestyle for me before my diagnosis, and I feel comfortable sticking with it now. My opinion about a lot of these fad MS diets is that what's really great about them is that they represent good nutrition for anybody. And that, you know, going on a diet like that as a person with MS would certainly do you good, but more because you're a human being than that you have a disease.
How does one prescribe exercise for somebody who's really debilitated, though? For instance, you know, Karen Ann was using a wheelchair quite quickly. What kind of exercise would you prescribe?
Well, we would begin always with a referral to a physical therapist who can work on a combination of reducing tone and spasticity, stretching, that sort of thing, help them find a manageable aerobic regimen that can work around their deficits. So we would always recommend that a therapist get them started at least, and then often the therapist can give them a regimen to follow on their own at home. And from there, it kind of depends on how motivated and committed the patient is and how much better it helps them feel. If they feel better from the exercise, that encourages them to continue it. But very often people will need refresher courses, so periodically I'll re-refer my patients to physical therapists.
Okay, Karen, and I want to ask you about this too. Do you believe in support groups? Are there support groups of people with MS that get together? Or like some people I've met who have chronic disease, they don't want to stay in the realm of disease world all the time, and they'd rather not have groups like that. Well, what is your feeling about that?
When I was first diagnosed, you couldn't have put enough distance between me and support groups. I eventually came around, and here's what I have learned about support groups. They can be tremendously helpful in terms of meeting up with people who can empathetically understand and identify with what you're going through. I think one has to be careful or should exercise some caution, though, because joining up with a support group where people have this one common denominator of, for example, multiple sclerosis, does not mean that you're going to find a kindred spirit. And so I think it's very important to keep expectations realistic. You know, it may just be that because you're the same person you were before you were diagnosed, you know, you have the same values and interests, and it may be that the friends who were good for you before your diagnosis are still going to be the best friends you've got with or without a support group. Now, I don't mean to disrespect support groups because I think that they really do serve an important function. I think that they're a good thing, but I think that, like I said, one has to be careful.
Yeah, I have heard people with cancer say that they don't want to continue to live in the valley of the unwell and be reminded of it all the time with people with different, you know, some people have just been diagnosed, some people don't know if the chemo's, you know, so I understand both sides of it, actually.
Yeah.
Now, I think we probably only have a few more minutes left, and I want to ask you if you think there's going to be any cures or breakthroughs. Well, what do you think the future is going to be for this disease? Any ideas?
Well, I think there are breakthroughs that are happening now. a really dramatic, some of the new medications reduced the relapse rate by 75%, 80%. I mean, really impressive numbers. Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, as I look at how we manage MS now compared to when I was in training, it's a whole different landscape. There's a lot of hope for folks with MS. And I did want to go back and reemphasize one thing Karen mentioned. The range of severity in MS is very broad.
Mm-hmm.
And the majority of patients have more minor disability and are able to work, to walk, to exercise. Some appear to be completely normal. Autopsy studies have shown that you can live a life perfectly normally and have MS of the brain, which is only discovered at the end of your life. So, but there's a wide range, but the majority of folks do not require a wheelchair. So there's plenty of reason for hope. In terms of recovering function, mostly what we offer now is the ability to prevent worsening.
Mm-hmm.
And to reduce relapses, which result in accumulated disability. We're not at a point yet where we can bring the nerves back.
Yeah. And how important is early diagnosis?
I think very. And we know now that that's the case more than we knew perhaps when you were diagnosed, Karen. There have been a lot of recent studies looking at what's called, we call clinically isolated syndromes. That would be the first attack, either of the optic nerve or possibly the spinal cord. If we evaluate patients at that time with a brain MRI and they have typical MS lesions in the brain, the risk of going on from that clinically isolated syndrome to MS is very high, 85%. Mm-hmm. If the MRI of the brain is normal at that time, the risk is quite low, 20% or so. And there have been quite a few studies now looking at beginning MS treatment even before the diagnosis is firmly made in these clinically isolated syndromes. And the early treatment delays significantly evolution into MS itself.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, we only have 1 minute left. Karen, I want you to have the last question. Do you have any recommendations, any advice for people who've just been diagnosed, loved ones who have family members who've been diagnosed?
I had a conversation recently, maybe I can offer this little preface. I had a conversation recently with a friend who wonders why I refer to it as my MS. She chided me a little bit for embracing the disease and, you know, quote, getting into bed with it, as though I was doing myself some sort of disservice by cozying up to it. And I feel exactly the opposite. I feel like it isn't my job to fight this disease or to separate myself from it. It's my job to recognize that my MS and I are inextricably linked. We're in this together. And the best way I can live with it is to acknowledge it, recognize its symptoms, how they work, what makes them better, what makes them worse, and to self-advocate, learn all you can from wherever you can, find a great doctor, and empower yourself to make your own decisions. I would say that's the best. And don't let anybody tell you that the answer is positive thinking. You know, I think we can sort of get caught there.
Well, we have run out of time. Thank you both so much for joining me. This was a great show. It was absolutely a wonderful show. Dr. Deborah Bradshaw and Karen Ann Petracca, we've been discussing multiple sclerosis. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. We are a sponsored project of the Art Spire, a program of the New York Foundation for the Arts. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.